Now we're going to cover a, Lord willing, a big chunk tonight. So I hope you have something to write with, and a Bible to read, and ears to hear. So let's get going as we transition now into chapter 10. We're in the book of Acts, chapter 10. And one of the reasons that we revisited last week this text that Brother David so kindly and graciously and well presented previously was so that we could end up where we were supposed to be geographically. And we look back in verse 42 of chapter 9, and it says, "And it became known throughout all Joppa, and many believed in the Lord." That's a very, as we've talked about before, that's a summary kind of statement. It again speaks to the expansion of the church. That's kind of the hovering over this whole book. It is all about, and it's intended to be about, how the church continued to expand, grow, multiply. And then in verse 43, "And he stayed in Joppa for many days with one Simon the tanner." Now, if we didn't have chapter divisions or verse divisions, we would understand why we're told who he's staying with. That's going to be important information that we're going to encounter tonight, in our text tonight. So bear that in mind, keep that in mind. He is staying with Simon the tanner. Now, what does a tanner do? Does anybody know? Tans hides, right. Does it seem odd to you that he might be staying with Simon, a tanner, remembering who he is? Who is Peter? What is he? He's a Jew. Does it seem unusual that he might be staying with a tanner, considering the fact that bloody animals were unclean? Not just unclean animals, but bloody animals of any kind were unclean. And so there's already some hint at what is about to transpire. So what we're going to do in this lengthy text tonight is we're going to break it down into several different sections. And these sections all kind of make up different scenes, if you would, of the story. And this story, this narration that is taking place by Luke, is the longest narration in the entire book of Acts. That length tells us a couple of things. It tells us that this is a strung out event, and it is. But more importantly, it tells us that this is a significant event. In fact, this comes as somewhat of a high point in the narration, in the whole book. It comes as a high point. In fact, we can look at this text as the beginning of the move outside of Judea. It takes place in Judea, but it is the stepping off point. Remember when in chapter 1, he says, verse 8, "You will be witnesses unto me in Jerusalem, in Judea, in Samaria, and to the uttermost parts of the earth." You remember that? And we took a little glance over the book, and we saw that that's actually how this book is outlined. Well, this becomes the stepping off point to Samaria and the uttermost part of the earth. It remains in Judea, but it's on the edge of Judea. So, with that in mind, here's the issue. Here's the issue that we're going to face, and it's the issue that we're going to be looking at all the way through most of chapter 11 as well. Okay? And this is the issue. The issue is, do the Gentiles have to become Jews in order to become Christians. Do they have to become Jews in order to become Christians? In other words, do they have to go through a proselyting phase in order to become Christians? Because where's the mother church? Where's the mother church of Christianity? Right, it's in Jerusalem. And it was the persecution that was activated somewhat by Saul that resulted in the scattering of these Jews throughout Judea and beyond. And so all they know is of Jews becoming Christians. What we called the Hellenists were Jews. They simply were Jews that had been assimilated into the Greek culture. They would still return. They would still go to Jerusalem for big feasts and festivals, big events. It was a treat for them to go and offer sacrifice at the temple. So this is a new issue, one that the church hasn't really considered, really had no need to consider, but it is about to become the issue. The second issue was whether or not a Jew could have table fellowship with a Gentile. And these two questions become the issue that could kill the church right here, right now. And it wasn't easily resolved. And so when Luke steps into discussing this matter, he lets the reader know how important it is by the length and by the repetition. The body of what we're about to study includes the story of two different visions. The first is a vision that Cornelius has. Cornelius is the Gentile in question. And then we discover in the narration that almost simultaneously, the Apostle Peter, who's where? In Joppa, with who? Simon the Tanner, has a vision as well. And through the narration, we find out that both people discover something that's very important. Both people respond to what they discover in these visions. And in their retelling of it to one another, they conclude what the reader is led to conclude, and that is, God was in all of this. There was a reason for this. And the reason becomes clear to Peter. And Peter is going to take this event and retell it so that his vision is told completely twice. Cornelius' vision is told four times in our text. So let's read a little bit of it. In verse 1, at Caesarea there was a man named... See how we just jumped. We just jumped from Joppa to Caesarea. Just about 30 miles up the coast from Joppa. Still in Judea. Out there at the edge. A certain centurion... or centurion, I'm sorry, of what was known as the Italian cohort. A devout man who feared God with all his household, gave alms generously to the people, and prayed continuously to God. Who feared God and all his household gave alms generously to the people and prayed continually to God. About the ninth hour of the day, he saw clearly in a vision an angel of God come in and say to him, Cornelius. And he stared at him in terror and said, What is it, Lord? And he said to him, Your prayers and your alms have ascended as a memorial before God. And now send men to Joppa and bring one Simon who is called Peter. He is lodging with one Simon, a tanner, whose house is by the seaside. When the angel spoke to him, who spoke to him had departed, he called two of his servants, a devout soldier from among those who attended him, a servant and a soldier. And having related everything to them, he sent them to Joppa. All right. So this introduces us to the first vision, the vision that Cornelius had. And these two visions have now, in all likelihood, both taken place, but you can't tell them both at the same moment in the story. So we go along with Cornelius to the point that the two servants are sent. We meet this main character here in this story. His name is Cornelius. The name Cornelius is a very, very common name at this point in history, and it is the name that was given to freed slaves. They were freed by a man named Cornelius, a military leader, freed these slaves, and they took his name as one of their names. So what this man's other names are, we aren't aware of, but it's in all likelihood he had other names. Another reason that I think we may not have his other names is because it's my sense as I read this book that Luke assumes his readers may know what Cornelius we're talking about here. He may have been well known. I mean, he's not an evil man. He's a good man. It says he is a centurion. Now, don't be misled in the belief that centurions all led groups of 100. That's what the word means, but it's a term of rank. And there were several ranks of a centurion. A centurion could have led a group of 100. A higher ranked centurion could have led a group of 600. A higher ranked centurion could have led a group of 10,000. I think that has a name all its own in rankings. But they would all have been centurions. It appears that Cornelius is of a higher rank. So with some good foundation for saying so, I would say he at least had charge of 600 troops. You know, when I'm reading this, I go back to an encounter Jesus had with a Gentile centurion. Do you remember? You'll find the story in Luke chapter 7, 1 through 10. And there, as here and elsewhere in the New Testament, centurions are presented in a very good light, which is kind of unusual when you consider the status that Christianity is going to have with respect to the Roman Empire. It is going to be troubled. And it's going to meet a lot of that trouble before the end of this book, or the chronology of the end of this book. But even as Luke looks back on it, he holds this centurion in high esteem, and he should be. He should be. He shouldn't be judged by the country from which he served, or the country which he serves. He shouldn't be judged by his role in the military of that country. He should be judged of his character. And he is. It's interesting that it was about this time that the Italian cohort, evidence of it is found about this. In fact, for centuries, no one believed there was anything called an Italian cohort. There was nothing in it in ancient Roman history. We didn't find anything in ancient descriptions. But it was into the 20th century that an archaeological discovery around this area, near Caesarea, a fragment of what appears to have been a statue, has an inscription in Latin saying, Italian cohort. It dates back to about, well, actually, they date it to 69. I don't know how they can be that precise, but that's when they date it to. This took place just a few years before that. Or I should say the writing of this book took place just a few years before that. So it was known then, but it's not known now. Now, we're also introduced to the town of Caesarea. Now, there are two Caesareas. This is Caesarea by the sea, also known as Caesarea Maritime by the sea. This Caesarea was a showcase city, and it had been made such by Herod the Great. Now, if you know anything about Herod, you know that Herod was kind of, he didn't fit in anywhere really well, Herod the Great, that is. He was a Roman with Jewish heritage, and he was given the provincial reign by Caesar over this area of Judea and Samaria. And Herod the Great had skills, significant skills. Herod the Great was an architect like no other. In fact, I spent a lot of the day just looking at some of the things online that Herod the Great built. This was one of those things. You recall, he built the temple. It's known as Herod's Temple. That's the temple of Jesus' day. But he built this city of Caesarea. He laid it out. He created a man-made harbor. You understand what I'm saying? With a fleet of slaves, he had scuba divers, literally, with made breathing apparatus, allowing them to dive and place platforms and pillars on bedrock that they also had to put in this harbor that they dug by hand. Outside of this harbor, Herod built a number of things. Some of them still exist. I mean, they're not in ruins. One of them is an amphitheater. In fact, I found a photograph anyway, I'm sorry. I'm going to tell you. They still use it to this day, the amphitheater. You know who Pink Floyd is? I found a Pink Floyd concert in this amphitheater, photograph taken in 2008. Same amphitheater, same stage. Not the same seats. Hallelujah. Behind the amphitheater, there was a temple. The temple of Augustus, the Caesar who had appointed Herod. The ruins of that temple are still there. How many of you have seen Ben-Hur? Some of you have. I haven't. I've seen, like everybody else, that scene where they're in a chariot and running around. You know where they were? I don't either, but they could have been. They could have been at the Hippodrome that is still there. The Hippodrome was a quarter mile long. It was 100 yards wide, and it was a long oval. And they held chariot races in the Hippodrome. What? Yeah, that's it. All they did was make left turns. And it held 13,000 people, and it's still there, and the seats are still there. On one side is an embankment built for seating. On the other side is the Mediterranean Sea. Go and look sometime. Type in your Google search. You can do it right now since you're bored. You can do it right now and look up Caesarea of Judea. Just look up images. If you search hard enough, you'll find an image that is one photograph of everything I just described. Or you could go with me next year to Israel and see it yourself. I'm just saying. So that's what's introduced to us in verse 1. There's a lot there, but there's as much in verse 2, and I can see we're not making good time. A devout man who feared God. Now, this is a Gentile, folks. But it says of him, he's a devout man. And he feared God. Those are two separate phrases. He's not just throwing hyperbole. These are two titles that Luke attributes to Cornelius, and they're significant terms. They're meant for us to note. Eusebes is the word devout. That is, he followed some formula. He followed a script in his life. He was devoted to it. And he, phabumenos, ton theon, he feared God, or he had the fear of God. This isn't the only time we've seen that term, and it's not the last we'll see of it. But it was a term that was used. Oh, actually, I'll remind you when we saw it. We saw this term regarding a guy who had become a Jewish convert from Ethiopia. Do you remember him? He was a God-fearer. He was a Gentile who had gone through the proselyting phase, and he had become a Jew, and he was a devout Jew. That is, he lived what he proselyted to, what he moved over to. He lived it. That was the Ethiopian eunuch. Nobody paid much attention to him because, you know, he was a Jew. We took little note of him. He was a Jew. He'd become a Jew. But this Cornelius does not appear to have made the full transition to Judaism. I'll show you in a moment why. But without having made that full transition, he's recognized for his devotion and his awe of God. He's a God-fearer. It doesn't mean that he was in terror of God, but he had awe and reverence for God. He worshiped God. He acknowledged at least some of the Jewish practices. As we read through this, what we find out is he performs, even in this little text that we've read, he performs two of three Jewish practices of worship. He prays. He gives alms. What he doesn't do in our text is he doesn't fast. That's not mentioned. That was a part of Jewish worship. So, he's already got some awareness of Jewish heritage and history. He has some knowledge, even though he may or may not be a converted Jew. He's prepared. He's prepped, if you would, for what's about to happen. He's aware of God. He's aware of Yahweh. He's aware of God's revealing Himself in history. He knows something. He's dwelling in a Jewish land. He probably knows something about a Jewish carpenter. I mean, who wouldn't know that information? And the stories that came out of that event, like some say he rose from the dead. Okay, so we don't have to go into a lot more detail. I just want you to see that he gets a vision. Who it is, where it was, and what that vision was. And the vision was, go ask for Peter. One important thing I said we're going to note is that Luke here records or gives us the details about how they were to find Peter. I mean, if you're going to tell him to go, in this case, you're going to have to give some information. Like, what city is he in? Well, he's in Joppa. And where in Joppa? Well, he's in the home of a guy named Simon. Simon is a tanner. And he's by the sea. He's on the coast. He's not in the interior of the city of Joppa. He's out there on the coast. That's pretty good directions. I mean, it's not Google Maps, but it's pretty good directions. And it's detail that should cause us to be alert. That's why Luke's giving this detail. He's showing that there is a lot of intricacy in this revelation. And he's aiming to show us God is behind every bit of it. And we haven't seen half of it yet. So look in verse 9. The next day, as they were on their journey, that is the two that were sent. By the way, these two that were sent, they waited on this Cornelius 24/7. That was their job. One of them was in the military, one of the underlings, if you would, and one of them was a slave, a servant, a household servant of Cornelius. He sends his best. He sends his best. My brother-in-law, hope he doesn't listen to this. I remember a few things from my childhood, but my brother-in-law is old enough to be my father. And Jack was in the military. He was in the Air Force. And he was stationed here at Lackland during that time. And he'd been to college. I didn't know that much about rank or anything like that. I do remember him being called, or him calling himself, a general's aide. Charlie, did generals have aides? Were they trusted?
Well, actually, not anymore.
Well, he was like the party planner. I mean, I don't know any other way to describe it. I mean, I listened to what he did, and it didn't sound very dangerous to me. And the Vietnam War was going on. But, oh, he knew stuff. He knew where things belonged on the table. I thought that was something only my mother knew. He knew those things. And he knew a lot more than that. He knew that when the general told him something, the general expected and trusted that it would be done. I get the feeling that that's the way this soldier was that was sent. Not just the household servant. No, sir. I want one of my soldiers to go. We've got to find this guy. He may not come willingly, but he's coming. Are you with me? We don't know anything about Peter. We're Cornelius. We're a centurion. We're told by a Lord. He presumed this was a representative of God. Go get this guy. Okay. Here's how I know to do it. The guy whose life I've entrusted mine to, my household servant, and the guy whose life is entrusted to me, this foot soldier, go get him. And they go get him. So, as they were on their journey and approaching the city, by the way, that's 30 miles. I don't know how they did that. You think they did that in what they call halftime? Peter went up on the housetop about the sixth hour to pray. That's noon. It's not lunchtime. Lunchtime would have been later in the afternoon. They'd have had an early morning breakfast, and they'd have had a later afternoon midday meal. But he became hungry, and he wanted something to eat. But while they were preparing it, he fell asleep. He fell into a trance. I didn't write that word. It's not a mere dream. It's more than a dream. And he saw the heavens opened and something like a great sheet descending. Does it say a great sheet? Or does it say something like a great sheet? Something like it. But I don't know how many times I've read that, and I just thought it was a sheet. It's a sheet. It doesn't say it's a sheet. It says it's something like a sheet. Now, why am I getting into that kind of detail? Because on the rooftop, do you know what happened to be on every rooftop? An awning. That's right. A tarpaulin kind of thing. With four corners to block the sun. Now, if you're up there on a rooftop and you're fading off into sleep, and you're laying under that thing and you see that as you fall asleep, just dream with me for a minute. Could it be that that enters your dream? Or if not that, remember where you are. You're by the sea. Maybe you're reclined under that tarp. And from where you are, you can see the sails on vessels in the sea. I don't know. What I do know is, it ain't a sheet. That's not good theology, is it? It is good theology. It's not good grammar. I'm sorry. Okay. He sees something like a sheet. Descending, being let down by its four corners upon the earth. In it were all kinds of animals and reptiles and birds of the air. And there came a voice to him, every hunter's verse, "Rise, Peter, kill and eat." But Peter said, "By no means, Lord." What did Cornelius say when that Lord told him to do something? He didn't say anything. He just did it. Peter says no. And if we were Peter, we'd have said no too. If we were Jewish, we'd have said no too. Peter goes on to say, "By no means, Lord, for I have never eaten anything that is common or unclean." And the voice came to him again a second time, "What God has made clean, do not call common." This happened three times, and the thing was taken up at once. Now that 30-mile trip, I assume that these two people sent by Cornelius had set out on the same day that Cornelius had the vision, or very early the next morning. So they approach Joppa about noon the next day. And Peter, in the meantime, is on the roof, asleep for how long? Some maybe moments, maybe seconds. We don't, you know, isn't it odd? Do you ever fall asleep in your recliner in the living room? Isn't that great? That's good stuff right there. But when you do, it's odd. I can hear the TV can be on, and I'm not awake. I think I'm awake. My wife hears me knowing I'm not awake, speaking the sleep language. And then I wake up and I can... Oh no, that didn't happen in that show. We're already on another show now. I thought I was watching that show, but you know, that show kept going in my mind. It keeps going sometimes in my mind. I just carry it on into my dreams. I'm not trying to mystify you. I just have dreams, and you do too, probably. Well, you do, most likely. Just don't remember most of them. Thank goodness. You know, Peter is awakened and he remembers this thing that the scripture calls a trance. So Peter is quite, as we see in a moment, he's quite perplexed about it. He doesn't know fully what happened or what it means completely. Something happens. But this sheet that contains all these representative creatures, animals of the earth, these four-footed animals, reptiles, birds. I guess they symbolize every kind of animal you can imagine. You know what it doesn't say? It doesn't say clean and unclean. It doesn't say that. We draw that inference. But it doesn't say they were clean and unclean there. It simply says that he won't eat of it. He won't eat of anything that's common or unclean. Okay? God says, the voice says, don't call anything literally impure that God has purified. Now, some scholars who read this text conclude that what is happening here is that Peter is, this vision is dealing with food laws. That's what it has to do with. Rather than some kind of interaction with Gentiles. And I've been thinking about that a little bit. You know, it obviously had something to do with food laws. I mean, that's the issue that arose in Peter's mind as he responds to this voice when it tells him to kill something and eat it. Now, whether or not there were clean or unclean in there is probably not as important, but if there were clean and unclean in there, why couldn't he pick out the clean and observe the food laws? Huh?
God did not tell him to, or the vision or whatever.
Didn't tell him to separate, pick them out. He just
says kill and eat.
I draw the conclusion that there aren't any clean animals in that thing. Maybe there were. Maybe there were. If it represented every animal, maybe there were. And the fact is, what the scholars argue is right, but it's not complete in my opinion. Because if you go back to Leviticus, the food laws are black and white. They're very black and white. But the reason behind them is equally black and white. The reason the food laws were given to Israel was so that Israel would be aware that God counted them different from everybody else. Are you with me? This is how you have to eat. And God knew if you have to eat this way, it is going to separate you from other people. The food laws were intended to separate Israel from other nations, ladies and gentlemen. So while this vision had something definitely to do with food laws, it had also to do, and Peter interpreted it correctly, it had something also to do with desegregating God's people. Pulling them together. No longer seeing people as in or out. Okay. You know, there is another thing. Even if there were clean animals in this sheet-like thing, do you know that those clean animals would have been what? Unclean. Because they couldn't have been prepared in a kosher way. So, that's why Peter said no to all of it. And I think that's something that that he's right to do. He was merely saying in this trance, boy, what kind of a dream do you just, you talk out loud? If you'd walked up, what if you were Simon and you walked up on the roof of your own house and there's a guy acting out and shouting out, no, and talking to God, saying no. All right, let's move on. In 2 minutes, do you think I'll get to verse 33? So we step into verse 17, and Peter doesn't know any more about the vision than he's just had. Now Peter, while Peter was inwardly perplexed as to what the vision that he had seen might mean, behold, the men who were sent by Cornelius, having made inquiry for Simon's house, stood at the gate and called out to ask whether Simon, who was called Peter, was lodging. And while Peter was pondering the vision, the Spirit said to him, behold, three men are looking for you. Rise and go down and accompany them without hesitation, for I have sent them. And Peter went down to the men and said, I am the one you are looking for. What is the reason for your coming? And they said, Cornelius, a centurion, an upright and God-fearing man, who is well spoken of by the whole Jewish nation. Maybe that's why we don't have to identify which Cornelius this is. Was directed by a holy angel to send for you to come to his house and to hear what you have to say. Verse 23, so he invited them in to be his guests. Do you see a paragraph break in your text there? Good. That's where it belongs. This verse should stop there and then resume with another verse. But this is correct. Anything unusual here? Tell me. What's unusual? He invited them in to be his guest. Correct. Very good. A Jew would never invite a Gentile into his home. It wasn't Peter's home, but he still wouldn't have done it. Couldn't have done it. Shouldn't have done it. Under the law. So, let's just race. We can do it. Let's just run down to the end and get this thing done. So they spend the night. I suspect, without saying it, they ate together. Okay. The next day he rose and went away with them, and some of the brothers from Joppa accompanied him. Oh, Peter takes an entourage. Are you with me? Peter takes a group of people with him. We find out in chapter 11, it's six people. And on the following day, they entered Caesarea. Cornelius was expecting them. Well, I guess he was. And he called together his relatives and close friends. When Peter entered, Cornelius met him and fell down at his feet and worshipped him. But Peter lifted him up, saying, stand up. I too am a man. By the way, the Western text, that is the Greek manuscripts from the Western side of the Holy Land, they're known as Alexandrian texts. Read, what are you doing? I'm just a man. Okay, whether it belongs there or not, I'm just saying. It's sort of like, well, anyway, I can't chase any more rabbits. Okay, so they have this polite encounter, and Peter lifts him up, and as he talked with him, We don't know what they said, but they talked. He went in and found many persons gathered. Many. We already know there were relatives and close friends. Now we know there were many of them. And he said to them, "You yourselves know how unlawful it is for a Jew to associate with or to visit anyone of another nation. But God has shown me that I should not call any person common or unclean. So when I was sent for, I came without objection. I asked then why you sent for me." Here it is, folks. Peter is covering his hide. May I say that? He's covering his hide. I'm doing what I was told to do, but you know as well as I know, this isn't normal. It's not normal. Even Jesus had to explain to a Samaritan woman why he would talk to her. You remember that? It wasn't normal. And so, I say he's covering his hide. Frankly, I'm glad he did. Because it clarifies for the reader what Luke's point is. And Luke's point is that Peter is changing. He's changing. I'm going to close. I got to stop. But I'm going to close with this. Is this somebody's Sunday lesson? I hope not. Okay. I wish I had been down here earlier and looked. Oh, that board's open. I'll use that one. In the field of psychoanalytics, psychotherapy, there's a branch called cognitive behavioral therapy. Ever heard of it? Cognitive behavioral therapy. There is an event that occurs, and that event evokes certain thoughts and images. Those images and those thoughts produce feelings. We call them emotions, okay? And those emotions result in actions. This is the story of cognitive behavioral therapy. Are you with me? An event occurs. What event occurred to these two men? They had a vision. They had a vision. To say that it evoked thoughts and images is an understatement, isn't it? They obviously had thoughts and images, but I'm talking about reflective thoughts and images. I'm not talking about the thoughts and images they had in the visions, okay? I'm talking about the follow-up thoughts after the fact. Remember, Peter was pondering what had happened. What do you think he was thinking? I'm just asking you. If you're a Jew, what are you thinking about? Are you terrified? I'd have to be terrified, folks. Because if Peter is to follow this vision, he may be breaking fellowship with every one of the other apostles. His credibility may be shot. kind of feelings would that evoke? I mean, I'm not asking you to be psychotherapist, but I'm asking you, if you were told that you were to violate a principle that you had known from childhood and that you'd been exposed to from birth, everyone you knew, trusted, respected, followed these rules, and you were told to violate those rules, wouldn't you try to go back to sleep and see if you couldn't recover that dream? Maybe I missed something. Maybe I'm just that hungry. Of course. He had to doubt it. He had to be fearful, anxious, worried. But what does he do? What behavior, what action did he take?
Revolt.
Hmm?
Revolt.
In the dream and in the vision, yes, he did. But he got that same thing three times, remember? After that vision, what did he do? That's right. He did what he was told to do. What I'm trying to get at is, it went against everything in Peter's being to do what he did, to go to Cornelius' house and to obey that vision. You know, I look back on the sermon at Pentecost, and I have to acknowledge, man, that took courage. That took courage. But I think this took more courage. It is one thing to be crucified and killed by people that killed your Lord for the same reason they killed Him. But imagine the horror of being shunned by the only people you call family now, the church. We'll stop there, okay? We'll pick this up next week. Let's pray. Father, I want to thank you for the courage you instilled in Peter, for the remarkable transformation he made. But I'm left to wonder, have I called common what you've called clean? Help me to be honest about it. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.